Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, the story behind a nature-loving architect who designed a number of sleek yet cave-like houses in Southern California, including one you might have seen in the movie The Big Lebowski, and a glimpse into the methodology of producer Harvey Weinstein. What moves a guy to take on a black-and-white silent film and make it a contender for the Oscars? And Mary J. Blige. She shook up R&B with her breakthrough album My Life 17 years ago. Now she's got a new album and a new outlook on her life. But first.
Okay, you may think it is the season of presidential campaigning, but in Hollywood, campaigns of a different sort are heating up. It is Oscar season, with studios orchestrating interviews, ads, and billboards aimed at Academy voters. Often the ads have the headline, "For Your Consideration." Remember, this is an election. And it's also a big season for producer Harvey Weinstein. He's credited with inventing the modern Oscar campaign, famously beating out Saving Private Ryan for Best Picture by campaigning for Shakespeare in Love. He's co-chairman of the Weinstein Company, and along with his brother Bob, founded Miramax Films. They've won scores of Academy Awards, including last year's Best Picture winner, The King's Speech. Renee's having a little trouble with her speech. She's out with laryngitis. But before totally losing her voice, she spoke with Weinstein.
Harvey Weinstein joined us to talk about his films and the business of making an art house movie, an Oscar winner. Good morning.
Nice to hear you, Renee.
Let's start with The Artist. It's gotten great reviews. But what was it in this film that had you seeing Oscar gold? I mean, it's black and white. It's silent almost totally. It stars two French actors who are stars there but unknown to American audiences. It would seem to be hard to find a film less likely to win an Oscar.
Well, I think that's the whole point. You know, I think sometimes we in the industry have to do ambitious projects. You know, here was a movie directed, no doubt, by a French director, but shot in Los Angeles, and it's an homage to American movies. You know, when we talk about Oscars, it also is a symbol of excellence, and the American public and the worldwide public accept that symbol. So on a movie like The Artist that costs $14 million and has to go out and compete with movies that cost $140 million, you know, how does David deal with Goliath?
How do you promote an independent film that a large percentage of the population might not think it likes, like a film which is black and white and silent, and get people into the theaters?
Well, it's alchemy. I don't know, you know. But, you know, I know one thing, that as I love cinema and I have such enthusiasm for it, perhaps it's helped me in my job, which is to try and get people to see these movies. I also grew up in politics, and, you know, I used to work for the Democratic Party, and when I first got into politics, I met Frank Sedita, who was the mayor of Buffalo. I mean, he was way past retirement, and he told me that, he said, you know, when I was young, Harvey, we didn't have media, TV, advertising, or any of those things to get a crowd, and I would always have to make a speech to get it voted. You know, people have to meet you, shake your hand. He said, it's hard to get people's attention. So he said, what we used to do is throw a little bomb in the middle of the street. Everybody would come out of their houses in the 1920s to see what all the fuss was. He'd grab a soapbox, get up and say, "Hi, I'm Frank Sedita." The metaphor to me was, if you can make some noise, perhaps you can find a way to get people away from seeing, you know, the stupider movie that week, you know, or the movie that the kids want to go to, but you just say, you know what, I'm sorry, guys, I'm going to go and nourish my mind instead.
You're promoting Michelle Williams' performance as best actress in the film My Week with Marilyn, which is Michelle Williams starring as Marilyn Monroe making a movie. But you also have another movie starring Meryl Streep as Margaret Thatcher. It's called Iron Lady. Are you going to give your two leading ladies competing campaigns for Best Actress?
It's not about a campaign, you know, with either of them. All I can tell you is there's no competition, you know, between these guys. They really aren't. They are artists. And so I don't. It's not about that.
Now, you expect us to believe that there's no competition whatsoever. Don't actors, actresses, don't they sometimes put in their contracts that they need
an Oscar campaign?
The,
we're talking about Michelle Williams and Meryl Streep. They're not that. Yes, you know what I mean? In answer to your question, yeah, there are people. Yes, and sometimes I've had to take out some of the funniest ads in my life, you know, for your consideration. And then you look at fill in the name and you, you go, oh, my God, this is embarrassing. Come on. What person put a gun to, you know, my head to make me take the ad out?
Can you give us an example?
No. No, I'd be, you know, whatever. I'd be unemployed if I did.
Well, you'd be certainly unpopular, I suppose.
You got that right.
But you don't seem to shy away from that, though.
I do shy away from that because I want to respect, you know, people. I'm not afraid to give an opinion, but I shy away from that.
Well, you once said that your reputation for being, people have called it brutal in terms of what you say to people about their work. You once chalked it up to basically to being honest in an industry where people tell lies.
I mean, where do people get words like brutal? If you sit down with somebody and say, look, I think we can improve this, and, you know, that wasn't quite what it should be. I mean, 99% of the time when I have to do that, it's quiet and, you know, done with great reserve. If there's a raising of a voice, it's only because it's the 20th time and it's exasperating. And I must admit, even though I'm the product of two Jewish parents, I think the Irish temper got in there somewhere. So I'm going to check mom's genealogy.
Most of us have an idea that an Oscar can make a film. I mean, the Oscars like you to think that, for sure. How valuable these days is an Oscar or even an Oscar nomination?
Well, let's take My Week with Marilyn, for example. If Michelle Williams gets nominated for an Academy Award, it will spur tremendous interest in the movie. My Week with Marilyn cost $10 million, you know, the whole movie. I mean, the work that everybody did and the sacrifices people made to do that on that kind of budget, it can transform the financial life of the movie. And more importantly than the fact that everybody makes a profit, which is not a bad thing, and that's a good thing, is the fact that if it works, more people, not us only, will make other kind of movies. They'll have the appetite for it. Last year when Black Swan, True Grit, and King's Speech all grossed over $100 million, it gave studios and independent financiers the confidence to make daring movies, you know, and not do the same old, you know what.
Harvey Weinstein, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
This week, the a cappella group Pentatonix was crowned the winner on season 3 of The Sing-Off. That's a vocal competition show on NBC. They got a Sony Music recording contract and $200,000, and then they got to come to NPR West and sing for us. As you can tell, their sound features strong bass lines and percussive beatboxing. No instruments, just the human voice.
Oh, oh. What did you tell them? Video killed the radio star. Video killed the radio star.
Pentatonix, as the name suggests, is made up of 5 singers. They are Scott Hoying, Avi Kaplan, Kevin Olushola, Kirsty Maldonado, and Mitch Grassi.
Star.
That was fantastic. Pentatonix, thanks so much. And Kevin, that's you beatboxing, the wild range of percussive sounds we're hearing, including that little kind of, what is that, a flute in the middle that you're trying to do?
Maybe a little bit of that.
It's an incredible thing. How did you learn to do that?
I just kind of always played around with it when I was a kid. I did a cappella for a year boarding school and then learned more when I was in China. I lived in China for a year and a half on a fellowship to study Chinese. Did some more there, learned from friends, and then started doing other combinations like playing cello and beatboxing together.
That's just a great big sound from five voices. It does sound like a whole lot more people in that room. Be sure
no,
there
thank
are.
You.
And Avi, you're supplying some of the low end there.
Yeah.
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 How low can you go?
Right now, probably like a low A.
Which is what? How does that sound?
Let me see.
I love you, Avi.
Yes.
Ooh. So, Scott, tell me about how the band started. You were in high school with Mitch and Kirsty in Arlington, Texas.
Yeah, I went to high school with Mitch and Kirsty, and the three of us kind of just started singing for fun. And we put a video up on YouTube with the three of us singing a trio song. And it got a little bit of attention, and people seemed to like it. And then when I went to USC and joined SoCal Vocals, I learned about the show The Sing-Off, and I decided I really wanted to try out with Mitch and Kirsty. And we decided to add a bass and a beatboxer. Avi, who we found through a friend, and then Kevin, we found on YouTube, playing cello and beatboxing.
Not
he has
too
a
many
viral
of
video. Not yeah. too many of those, and so it added a whole lot.
It definitely filled out the sound.
This is Mitch?
For sure. Yes, this is Mitch, by the way. yeah, because before we didn't have that low end in our songs, and we also had to snap for vocal percussion, or lack thereof. So, yeah, we would right. just snap our fingers along.
Or worse, we would try to beatbox ourselves.
That yeah. was really bad.
Which was, it was, you know, A for effort. It wasn't terrible.
Well, give us just a sense. Give us a little bit of a song out there live in the studio.
Okay, sure.
Oh, you're an alien, your touch so foreign, it's supernatural, extraterrestrial. You're so hypnotizing, could it be the devil, could it be an angel? Your touch magnetizing, feels like I have floating. You're from a whole other world, a different dimension. You open my eyes, and I'm ready to go leap into the light. Kiss me, kiss me, infect me with your love, and fill me with your poetry. Take me, take me, wanna be a victim, ready for abduction. Oh, you're an alien, you're touched so supernatural, extraterrestrial. This is transcendental, on another level. Oh, you're my lucky star. I wanna walk on your wavelength, and be there when you vibrate. For you, I'd risk it all. Kiss me, infect me with your love, and fill me with your poison. Take me, take me.
Wanna be
ready for abduction. You're an alien, your touch so foreign. It's supernatural, extraterrestrial.
Wow. Now, who was doing that sound? It sounds almost like a mouth harp in there.
Avi,
that's you? How do you do that? Can you tell us, or would you have to, you know, shoot us?
I wouldn't shoot you, I promise. let's see. Really what you do is you take the natural overtones in your voice, and you accentuate them with your tongue in your, you know, mouth.
Okay, demonstrate, because we can all try this at home. Wow. That is an amazing thing.
Thank you.
I can just picture listeners all over the country right now trying to do what you just did and failing terribly.
Yeah. I mean, it's really fun, and it's cool because we do only have five people. So if I can sing two parts at once, that's always nice.
Wow. Mish, can you describe when I can't see, Avi, because you're out in L.A., can you describe what he looks like when he's doing that?
Yeah, it looks like he is, I don't even know, it's...
It looks like he's about to kiss someone, but really
it looks it. Like...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like I'm scared to give you a kiss.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's very sexy.
What can I say?
Well, Kevin, Avi, Scott, Mitch, and Kirsty, thanks for coming in to talk with us and to sing for us. Would you sing us out with something?
Of course.
Bum, 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 bum. Bum 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 bum. Hello, hello, baby, you call, I can't hear a thing. I have got no service in the club, you see,
Kevin Alushala, Avi Kaplan, Scott Hoying, Mitch Grassi, and Kirsty Maldonado are Pentatonics. You can see videos of more Pentatonic songs at npr.org.
Sorry, I cannot hear you, I'm kind of busy. Just a second, it's my favorite song they're gonna play. Then I cannot teach you with a drink in my hand. You should have made some chance, but I knew that I was free. But now you won't stop calling me, I'm kind of busy. Stop calling, I don't want to think anymore. I left my head and my heart on the dance floor. Stop calling, I don't want to talk anymore. I left my head and my heart on the dance floor.
The collection of architect John Lautner is attracting attention these days, too. You may have seen some of the homes that he designed in Hollywood movies. Mr. Lautner was not nationally well-known when he died in 1994, but his hometown of Marquette, Michigan, has honored him with two exhibitions in this, the centennial year of his birth. Edward Lifson reports.
John Lautner spent his adult life in Los Angeles, but coming from the Northwoods and then working with Frank Lloyd Wright, L.A. was an adjustment.
It was so damn ugly, I was physically sick for about a year because I'd been used to the beauties of everything beautiful, and here everything's ugly. I couldn't imagine doing anything as ugly as Los Angeles.
That's Lautner in the 2009 documentary Infinite Space. He always tried to encourage deep respect for nature in everything he designed, from his influential 1949 Googie's coffee shop to the family houses Hollywood now uses as super cool bachelor pads in Diamonds Are Forever, A Single Man, and The Big Lebowski.
Hello, dude. Thanks for coming. I'm Jackie Treehorn.
The villain pornographer in the cult classic lives in a Lautner. He and the dude negotiate under a huge, angled-up, triangulated slab of concrete that serves as a roof.
It's quite a pad you got here, man. Completely unspoiled.
What's your drink, dude?
White Russian, thanks.
White Russian.
Lebowski chills on a Lautner-designed sofa. Rays of light dapple the living room through 750 drinking glasses that John Lautner embedded in the concrete roof. His desire was to recreate the rays of light that pierce through tree canopies in old-growth forests, like the one he spent time in as a boy. Those experiences were central to his architecture.
When I first started, I thought about the cliff dwellers and the nomads and what people really are, you know, psychologically and every other way. And they want to be free, but they want a little shelter.
Lautner's houses have cave-like areas to provide a sense of security. You feel grounded. And then, with your back to the shelter, he gives you hypnotic views of heaven, city, forest, ocean, any entity larger and more meaningful than a single-family home. Case in point, the Elrod House in Palm Springs, which Lautner built around existing boulders on a hillside. Wim DeWitt heads the Department of Architecture and Contemporary Art at the Getty Research Institute, which holds Lautner's archives.
The first time I walked in there, you stand in the house, you see that huge structure around you with this concrete vault above you and the rocks coming out of the mountain into the house, and you stand there and then all of a sudden somebody pushed a button and the glass wall opened up. That is just an experience that I think everybody should have once in their life.
In Lautner houses, redwood walls swing open on hinges, skylights open to the heavens. So-called infinity pools start in the house, flow under glass walls, outdoors, and then seem to drop off the side of the earth. His most famous house might be the Chemisphere in the Hollywood Hills, an eight-sided capsule on a pole that looks like the Jetsons would live there. It was really just a low-cost way to build on a bad site without ruining the natural landscape and, of course, to provide views. The materials had to be hauled up the side of the hill, partly by the client himself, directly recalling John Lautner's experience as a boy back in Michigan, when he helped his parents build a house on a rock shelf overlooking Lake Superior. His mother, an artist, named it Midgard, Norse for between heaven and earth.
To be at Midgard, it's a little bit like you've been taken back in time.
Melissa Matusak is the director and curator of the DeVos Art Museum at Northern Michigan University in Marquette, which helped organize two exhibitions for Lautner Centennial.
When you stand out on the rock in front of Midgard and you look over Lake Superior, you literally feel like you're floating over the water. It's very quiet. It's very serene. I think you get very close to this idea of sublime. I really do. I can't think of a whole lot of other places that I've felt such a powerful force of nature.
Matusak wants the locals to appreciate John Lautner, and as he did, the beauty around them, and maybe even to feel Lautner's longing to be home.
I like to think that when Lautner was designing these houses, and he's out in L.A., and he's so far away from where he absolutely loved to be, I think that some of these houses he was hoping to sort of recapture this boyhood wonder and feeling and gazing out into the landscape and sort of feeling like you were really joined between yourself and the landscape that you see.
Many owners of Lautner houses in Southern California say they've never felt as comfortable anywhere else. Michael Lefetre has lived in a Lautner in Malibu for years.
I would be lying if I said that I giggled every morning. But the truth is, when you see the play of the wood and the concrete, inevitably, by the time that I've walked down to have my first espresso, I've, at the very least, smiled, if not giggled out loud.
If a house can do that, I want what he's having. For NPR News, I'm Edward Lifson.
Starting this week in New York City, you might look up from a busy intersection and see...
says aggressive driver, aggressive pedestrian, two crash test dummies.
Traffic warning haiku street signs are appearing on poles around the five boroughs. They're posted by the New York City Transportation Department. The poems and accompanying artwork were created by John Morse, who joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess there are 12 designs in all, right? 10 in English and 2 in Spanish?
That's right.
And why haiku as opposed to something that just says, look both ways before crossing?
Poetry has a lot of power. If you say to people, walk, don't walk, or look both ways, if you can tweak it just a bit, and poetry does that, the device gives these simple words power.
Could you share a couple of your favorites with us?
Cyclist writes screenplay. Plot features bike lane drama. How pedestrian. I'm glad you like it.
I like that one a lot, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like, it's fun because it's dreadfully serious, the subject, and yet you don't have to bang people over the head.
So, and the theory goes that people might pay attention to the haiku in a way they may not to traditional signs because they're just used to that as background?
Yes, sir. There's a lot of visual clutter, of course, all around us. So the idea is to bring something to the streetscape that might catch someone's eye in that one moment that they pause, perhaps, will cause them to think twice about stepping into traffic or jaywalking. One of the haiku is oncoming cars rush, each one a 3-ton bullet, and you, flesh and bone. Because I think a lot of people, and all of us, but, you know, particularly teenagers, for instance, you feel invulnerable.
Can I try one on you?
Oh, yes, please.
Holland Tunnel traffic is backed up to Grant's tomb. Honks are exhausted.
It's great.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you know, one of the joys of doing this sort of thing is how many people have responded to it with their own haiku, mm-hmm. that there's just a plethora of haiku coming out, and it's so exciting.
Well, smooth sailing through the streets to you, Mr. Morse.
Thank you kindly.
Traffic haiku artist, and a whole lot more, John Morse.
Imagine a world where your every move matters. Welcome to that world.
17 years ago, Mary J. Blige shook up the world of R&B when she released the record My Life, and she ushered in a new sound, the sound of soul music over hip-hop beats. And instantly, Mary J. Blige became known as the Queen of Hip-Hop Soul. This record, My Life, was about pain, about Mary J. Blige's rough childhood and her battles with addiction and depression. 17 years on, she's revisited that album, a sequel of sorts. This one's called My Life 2, The Journey Continues. Mary J. Blige has won Grammys in pop, rap, gospel, and R&B. My Life 2 debuted this week on the Billboard charts at number 5, and when we spoke with her, Mary J. Blige explained what it's all about.
Strength. It's about strength because there was so much pain on the My Life album, the first one, but there's been so much growth and evolution and strength gained through all the years of, putting out albums. And the thing that we've gained is strength and understanding, and that's what I want people to celebrate, because we were not celebrating strength and understanding or even life on the My Life album. We were just trying to figure out how we were going to dodge death.
You open up with a song about how you feel inside. Tell me about that feeling.
I wanna make you happy. Well, feel inside is basically about a woman, any woman, and so many women have felt this, including myself. Just, she cannot tell everyone how she's feeling. You know, in public, everyone thinks her life is so great, think that she's being loved and respected at home. And the truth is that she can't tell anybody how terrible she feels because she's not being respected or paid attention to or probably even loved at home.
It's interesting because I've seen videos of some of your recent performances, and what's notable is you see a lot of women crying in the audience. Women, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you have many, many fans who are men as well, but women connect with your music in a visceral way.
Well, women connect with my music in a visceral way, and, you know, just period, because I'm a woman and I don't run away from that. And so I get every woman out there. I am every woman out there. And they honestly connect with me because I'm honest with all my feelings.
I want to ask you about your childhood. Your mom was a nurse. Your dad, he was a jazz musician. He left home when you were just a kid. And you've been public in your life about having been sexually abused as a child. I mean, you've dealt with addiction and depression, and you've sang about these things in different ways over the course of your career. But on this record, it sounds like you've really reached a place where you've kind of come to terms with all of those things. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. The things I can't change, you know, all I could have done in my life is what I did. Forgive my abuser, move on with my life, and, you know, just try to make the best of what I have, you know. So I'm in a place of, you know, I'm comfortable with what and who I am.
Living proof. Oh, yes, I. I wanted to talk to you last year, actually, already, because of an amazing story. You actually went back and managed to get your GED, the high school equivalency. I mean, you're successful, you're rich, you're respected, and yet you felt like you needed to do this. Why? Why'd you do it?
Well, I didn't finish high school, and for years I felt like I just was embarrassed and ashamed about so many things. It was even more embarrassing when I couldn't articulate myself. It was even more embarrassing when I would watch other people articulate themselves and speak slowly and not blink and not stutter. And I still do all those things, but at least I can get my thoughts out now. And it gives me confidence. I have confidence now because I can sit here with you and not be afraid of how I'm going to answer your questions.
Was there a time when you were afraid?
Absolutely. I was afraid because I was ashamed of, you know, ashamed of the fact that I couldn't articulate myself. I couldn't get the things out that I wanted to get out.
It's amazing to hear that, because what you sing about requires so much intelligence and thought and empathy, and yet you never thought of yourself that way.
I know, it's weird. It's weird when you think about it, but I guess the only thing I really, really knew is what the streets and the world taught me. So I had to unlearn a lot of the negative stuff. I kept a lot of the stuff that is saving my career right now, which is common sense, you know, humility, manners.
This record is a journey, as you've aptly titled it, and you've traced that arc. Where are you going now?
I'm going to live further than this. I'm going to excel. I'm going to grow. I'm going to be better than what I am, because I am so not perfect. I have so much more to learn. I have so much further to go. I don't feel complete about, you know, my life. And not in a negative way, but I just know in my spirit there's so much further to go. There's so much more to learn. There's so much more to do.
Mary J. Blige, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Mary J. Blige. Her new record is called My Life 2. The journey continues.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.